There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
The Science of Sports podcast with Professor Ross Tucker and sports journalist Mike Finch. Coming up in this episode,
crowds of people, some of them not wearing masks, up against the athletes.
What we know is that outdoor transmission is exceptionally rare compared to indoor. One of the things to improve trust in cycling would be give people the power data. To start with is that there's actually a very poor correlation between power output and finishing position in a sprint.
So if you're like Ross and I, you've been watching the last 10 days of the 2020 Tour de France. We are talking to you on the first Monday rest day of the 2020 event. And maybe by the time you listen to this, which will probably be on the Tuesday, things would have changed. But we're not going to try and preempt anything in this podcast. We're just trying to give you some insight into what we've seen in 2020. And it has been a very surprising tour. I think for those of you that love cycling, you will have enjoyed some of the racing out there. I certainly have. And it has been a tour where normally what we see in a Tour de France is we see lots of flat stages in the first week and then it kind of goes into the mountains. Whereas this year, we've seen lots of hills in the first week and lots of excitement. But before we get on to that, we do have to pay a very special big thank you to our patrons on Patreon. And a couple of our new patrons have donated some money to our worthy cause, keeping us alive here and making a little bit of money to make it worth our while. So I'm going to ask Ross just to give some of the names of our new patrons on our patrons on Patreon.
Thanks, Mike. So we have four since the last podcast. The last podcast, by the way, was supplements.
That's right.
If you missed it, have a listen to that.
Juicy one.
We'll save you the money on supplements so that you can donate to us on Patreon. Jokes. Four people to welcome into our Science of Sport family. Harry Munro has come in at the Olympic athlete level. Thanks Lovely. Very much, Harry.
Thanks, Harry.
Then two Olympic champions this week. They are Colin Thompson and Patricia Holburn. So thanks very much to you. That's the middle level. That's our Olympic champion. And then we have an Olympic legend who we are crowning this week. That person is Chris Gaskin, who's gone in at the top level of donations. So thanks very much to all four of you, and a particular thanks to Chris Gaskin, who is the latest in our family of Olympic legends. And as Mike says, you go onto patreon.com, look for the Science of Sport. That's where you can donate to keep us going. I mean, we're going to go anyway. I always say that. It's not like we're holding ourselves to ransom or hostage here. We go anyway. And if you're grateful and feel the need or the inclination to donate, then we are very grateful for you.
If you like what we do, we'd like to see if you can donate us some money. That's basically what we're asking. Quite right. So big thank you to all of our patrons on Patreon, because they certainly guys have been very enthusiastic over the last couple of months, and we really do appreciate your financial contributions. But let's get on to the meat of what we're talking about today, and that is the 2020 Tour de France. And Ross, I will tell you that I have really enjoyed this first week, probably more than I've enjoyed the first week of a Tour de France ever, purely because we've seen a lot of climbing. We've seen some big stages, almost queen-like stages. We've seen some surprises. We've seen some amazing performances from some outsiders. And we've also seen some performances from the well-known riders, but also almost a slight changing of the guard between the old Sky team, which is now Ineos Bombardiers or whatever.
Grenadiers. Looking at the scenery there, are you, Mike?
I can't keep up to date with all the names of the teams. But, of course, Jumbo-Visma, the team that everybody's watching at the moment. But
yeah, you can't avoid them.
You can't avoid them. The yellow, the canaries of the Tour de France. But your assessment, I mean, how have you seen this first week of the Tour?
I'm really enjoying what it's building to become. I don't want to downplay what's happened in week one. But based on what we've seen in the last 2 days, where they finally did some mountains, well, not finally, but big proper mountains in the Pyrenees, it seems to me that we're going to get one-on-one battles when we get to the big mountains, you know, because the tempo of the race, the way that it's been set up is, yes, Jumbo's been dominant up to the last stage of the climb. But once those attacks are coming, they're fragmenting pretty quickly. And I'm quite looking forward to seeing how that plays out. We've seen the emergence of some unbelievable young guys. Pogacar from Slovenia seems like the guy to watch in the next phase of the mountains. Having lost time in the wind, which was maybe the surprise on Thursday.
And he was the big guy that everybody said last year was going to be the new guy to watch in 2020. And he was
20 years old and he got a podium in the Vuelta.
Yeah.
And I remember we interviewed Adrian Rotana, who's a team doctor with his team. And he said, you've got to watch this guy. He's an unbelievably young talent. And at 21, yesterday's stage win was the youngest stage winner since the infamous Armstrong in 1993.
Mm-hmm.
He set records on both those climbs. We'll get to that. So he certainly is like the form guy, but there's 2 weeks to go. And the prevailing wisdom has always been that the young guys don't have it in them to go the 3 weeks. So that'll be in. So there's a lot of interesting things to watch. Roglic has been dominant all season. Does he have it in him to stay there for two more weeks, or is he going to fall off that peak? Mm. Bernal was very good, then didn't look as flashy in the Dauphiné. There was talk of a back problem. He pulled out. Yesterday, he started to look, actually, maybe he's coming right. Maybe he'll be better in the third week of the tour than he was now. There's Quintana, who looked great on Saturday and not so good yesterday. Mm. Landa finally looked like he was coming into the role of a team leader on the GC race. So you have all these little subplots, these individuals who... So I'm quite excited by what's going to come. I hope we get there, though. Because the big thing is, by the time you all listen to this, some of these teams might have been sent home because nobody knows what the COVID testing is going to reveal. I mean, as we sit here talking about it, they are testing riders. And where they get positive tests, they will retest them because there's a lot of fear of false positives. And where teams have got two staff or riders positive, they are apparently going to be sent home. Now, I'm quite optimistic that that's not going to happen, but it could. And then all our hopes for the next 2 weeks are gone.
When you say you're optimistic about that, but one of the things that's been a theme on Twitter is the crowds that have been up on the climbs that the riders have been riding through. And although most, I would say, 80% of the people on those mountains are probably wearing masks, we know that masks don't necessarily, you know, they don't totally stop it. But there's a lot of people who aren't wearing masks. And I must admit, I look at those riders going up some of those climbs over this last weekend, and it makes me nervous to see so many people, like the Tour de France of old, but in the middle of a pandemic. There's all these images on Twitter where people are saying, what pandemic? And there's all these crowds of people, some of them not wearing masks, up against the athletes, so close to them, shouting into their faces. I mean, is there a real risk that a pandemic could spread by a bunch of people shouting at cyclists going up a climb?
There's a risk. I'd hate to guess what size it is. What we know is that outdoor transmission is exceptionally rare compared to indoor.
Yeah.
So in China, for instance, there were 319 outbreaks or clusters. One of them was an outdoor event. 318 were indoors. In Japan, for instance, they had assessed that the risk of an outdoor transmission was 5% that of an indoor one. So when you are outside, the risk is so much lower that it almost becomes, in some instances, negligible. Then we know from these epidemiological tracing studies that you need a fair amount of exposure or a fairly high exposure. Now, I can't see that happening when a cyclist whizzes by a guy at 20k an hour and the exposure is literally half a second, less even.
Yeah. So even if he's shouting into his face without a mask on.
So then that's the only circumstance, is like not direct face-to-face, but really close face-to-face contact, shouting at him. There go those water droplets. The spittle goes from the fan's mouth onto the cyclist. He has to not be wearing a mask. I suppose even if he is, some could still get through. But it just seems the probability of that transmission is exceptionally low. Now, I'm not condoning what we saw, especially on the Parasord on Saturday. It was crazy dense.
Crazy.
And we know that we should be encouraging outdoor, but also not massive groups and high density. And they failed on two of those three counts. So it would have been better to see fewer fans or spread them out over twice the distance. But I'm still holding on to a degree of optimism that the context in which the race is moving is much less likely to cause a transmission than when they're at the start and the finish and you have people potentially interacting for 5-10 minutes at a time within a space of 1 meter indoors, in the hotels, in the in the press. Well, they don't have press rooms. That's one of the safety things they've done. I think that the risk is going to be much higher there than on the road.
Yeah.
So, yes, it's not a great look. It's a funny look because you've got these guys coming up to the podium and there's no ceremony now. They just sort of stand there, wave, and off they go. They've got their masks on. That's an incredibly low-risk situation also. It's also outdoor. Yet they've taken all the precautions, and then on the bike, no precautions at all, it looks like. So I get why there's consternation and anger and concern.
Yeah.
But I'm optimistic that it's going to be a false concern for now, I hope.
So, I mean,
the
hype around Twitter, essentially what you're saying is be realistic. There's no chance, but it isn't as bad as it looks sometimes.
And the other thing is that symptomatic spread is much more common than asymptomatic. So if a person's not showing those symptoms, they're much less likely to give the virus or the disease to someone else. Now, what's the probability that a guy who's gone up on those mountains and spent the day there is symptomatic? I don't think that symptomatic people are really going to be in high numbers on those climbs. Maybe I'm looking for reasons to stay optimistic, but I think that there is a COVID-19 induced polarization here of opinions. I'm hopeful that the tour will have avoided the worst of it from the fans. I still think the big concern is what happens between 6 p.m. and 11 a.m. the next day. That for me is a bigger concern than what happens on the road.
So perhaps the biggest concern for the riders is the overwhelming smell of garlic more than anything else up in those French mountains.
And whiskey. Apparently, I think it was one of the Movistar guys said I could smell whiskey on the guy. Because they go up there and they're drinking. Because you got to get up those climbs early.
Yeah, yeah.
What are you going to do? You just sit there drinking and
eating,
preparing for the
eating garlic bread and drinking
15
wine.
Seconds of fame you'll get on television. So
it does drive me nuts. I mean, it's a complete aside. But I think that one of the things that frustrates me so much about cycling commentators on television is when they try and tell the people on the side of the road, please do not do this, and all these spectators doing these crazy things on the road. But it is so much part of cycling. And yes, there's a part of you that goes, oh, I just hope this guy gets out the way. But that is what it's about, and it is almost part of the sport. And I never really understand why the cycling commentators get their knickers in or not about it, because it's like, so what? They're over-enthusiastic. Admittedly, maybe once or twice in the history of the Tour de France, a spectator's taken out a rider. But it doesn't happen as often as you think, really, does it?
No. But I suppose once, if it's
fair enough.
You know, like the photographer that steps out and gets cleaned up or a guy. Yeah, I mean, we've seen races, stages certainly influenced and decided by it. So you don't want it to happen. But, right now, there are concerns over and above fans interfering with the race. I mean, the fan could give a disease or virus to someone who then gives it to three other people who give it to three other people. And now you've got it affects the integrity of the whole event. And by this time tomorrow, we'll know what's happened. And I'm really hopeful that that's not the case. Because it has been an exciting tour. And I think it's quite an open tour, notwithstanding the dominance of one team. But by the time you get to the last 4 or 5K on a climb, that dominance has also been gone in the last few days. So I'm hopeful and looking forward to the next 2 weeks.
I must say, when it comes to tragedy, and I don't mean, maybe I'm overstating the fact on this one, but Mark Hirschi yesterday losing that stage. And it was such a wonderful moment. He got away with 90 kilometers to go, the Swiss rider. The TV guys were going nuts about this guy. Anybody that was watching, even if you weren't a cyclist and you watched a bit of that, here's this lone leader. Nobody else was attacking. It was a furious pace early on. Everybody tried to attack. Hirschi gets away on the climb. Then he gets caught, 3 kilometers from the finish by the lead bunch, including Roglic and Pogacar. And then cleverly, and the commentators picked up this quite quickly, of course, he knows that he's got a reasonable sprint in him. He sits up. He waits for those guys to come past because they're chasing GC time. He gets on the back and you think, he could win this still, man. It would be unbelievable. And Pogacar beats him. And what it showed me a little bit, I know Pogacar was obviously incentivized by the fact that he got some bonus seconds as the winner, but it shows you a guy like Tadej Pogacar is a proper racer. I mean, he is a guy. He's not going to hang back on sentiment. He's not going to hang back on, maybe we should just, give Hirschi this. It doesn't matter. It's a brutal world. Hirschi buried himself and was, 10 meters away from winning probably the stage of the tour, and he might never get that close again in his entire career.
Well, I think he will, because he seems to be.
He's on form.
He doesn't seem like the guy who the peloton let escape, and that was his moment. He seems like a guy who'll work his way into similar situations in future. It would be. I mean, if Pogacar had broken clear of that group on the ascent and caught him on the descent, and it was just the two of them, he would have let him win. I think.
Yeah. True.
Although he needs that 10 seconds, you see.
With
the time bonus, yeah. Maybe not, you know. Yeah. But, yeah. Like, he would have been assured of at least finishing ahead of Roglic.
Yeah.
If he'd been ahead. So the time bonuses may have cost Hirschi there a little bit. I mean, four guys catching a guy are never going to let – all four aren't going to let him beat them.
No.
One guy might have. You've seen that in the past.
There's no sentiment.
But, yeah, you're right. With the time bonuses, especially – one thing that's interesting to speculate coming back to the COVID thing is – If the race is in some jeopardy, and I think it's fairly low probability that the race ends today, those two stages on the weekend could have been the decisive stages in the race. You needed to be in yellow by Sunday night.
And do you think Roglic knew that? Do you think the teams thought, well, if it ends on Monday,
I don't know.
They're going to declare him a winner?
I don't know. I've listened to one or two podcasts on the tour, and they're sort of split over it. Will the teams plan their race? I mean, they're riding into a rest day anyway, so you can afford to go maybe all out Saturday, Sunday. So that might not give you an indication. But I was listening to the Move podcast. Have you listened to that, by the way? I'm interested in your thoughts on it. So
I love it.
What do you think of it?
Well, Lance.
Yeah.
I love it. I think, you know, as much as I'll probably be ridiculed by the greater universe about my love for Lance Armstrong, but I'm in the school of thought that, you know, Lance was part of a system and he was the full guy. He wasn't a good guy, but he was certainly the full guy. But he does a great podcast and I think he adds insight that I think is quite interesting to listen to.
I've listened to a couple of them and the first thing I'll say is like they're 30 minutes long and 10 minutes of it's adverts.
Yeah, that is sad.
And it's like, I remember at the start.
Making more money than we are there.
Well, yeah.
Come on, Patreon.
We need a sponsor. We won't spend 30% of our podcast selling you a ring that tells you how well you sleep. Because literally the first 6 minutes of the podcast is Lance telling us how he slept really well. Yeah. And he credits this aura ring that they wear or something as if that's putting him to sleep. I mean, it's – anyway. So
We're not ever going to do that. We promise that.
You know, on the app, you can skip forward 30 seconds at a time. I skip. I still next one. Eventually, like 10 pushes later, okay, now we finally got to cycling.
Yeah.
What I do enjoy on that is I like Hincapie's views.
Yeah.
I think he has a very measured and lucid way of explaining things, which is cool. And then when they speak to guys like Schleck and Brenil, I like the insights they get.
Yeah.
And anyway, just tangentially, the point was that they were speculating on whether teams would race the tour as though it was a 9-day race that then resumes on day 11, or would they just pretend that this wasn't a potential banana skin on the rest day. And yeah. I don't know. But anyway, the point was Hirschi was never going to get a gift given that there were time bonuses on the line and especially with the big four looming behind him.
I mean, Hirschi was also involved in probably, if you talk about a sort of a local favorite, Julien Alaphilippe's win, I think, on stage number 2 when he beat Hirschi in the sprint after attacking on the final climb was certainly, I think, one of the great moments in cycling, because not only is Alaphilippe sort of a god in French cycling, but the way that he attacks, you know, he's got a Contador-esque way of riding a bike. He's not, you know, he's not looking on his power meter. He's going on climbing. He operates on passion. He attacks sometimes completely outrageously, but there's a panache about him that I absolutely love. And you can't deny that he is great for cycling, Julien Alaphilippe, and him winning that day, I thought, was a great moment.
Yeah. And that one actually, Hirschi lost his wheel. He just I don't know if there's a lapse in concentration or if he was thinking about maybe Yates was going to do something and not Alaphilippe, but he just lost that wheel. And he actually, it's interesting because he actually finished faster than Alaphilippe, and he might well look at that as a missed opportunity.
I thought Alaphilippe spotted that. When you look at the footage, I watched that. Alaphilippe looked around, and as soon as he was slightly off the back of the wheel, he went and got that 10-meter gap. And it was, I think, it was a bit of genius from Alaphilippe. I'm a fan.
Could have been. But anyway, Hirschi's had two, let's call them near misses.
And yeah.
He's on a steep learning curve, but that you would be at that age in your first Grand Tour of any kind, never mind the Tour de France. So, and then Alaphilippe, Okay, so he wins yellow, then he loses yellow on a technicality. And then he attacked on Saturday for about 20 seconds. And the moment he was caught, he just dropped it back into the group. I mean, he lost many minutes on that day. So he's had a weird tour, not nearly like 2019 for him so far.
Do you not think it's a bit like Alaphilippe? We're probably digressing slightly off the many subjects we're going to talk about today with Alaphilippe, that you, when you attack, you know how your legs are going to feel with that maximal effort, and you go, oh, it's not happening today. I'm just going to bat out the back here and wait for another day. I mean, is there some value in that?
Yeah, given the way they ride the climb, where it's jumbo on the front and they're setting that super high tempo, and we'll get into the physiology of this in a moment, but pretty much the top 20 to 30 guys in the race are all close to or above their critical power or their MLSS, whatever. Go back and listen to our two podcasts back, I think it was, or three actually. Yep. We did a podcast called What the FTP, yep, and we explain these concepts, and we'll revisit them now, I think. Mm-hmm. Everyone is pretty close to their CP. You know if you've got good legs at that
critical power, for those of you who don't know what that is.
Yeah, or their MLSS is maximal lactate steady state. They're close to their limit for a sustainable steady state effort. You know if you've got good legs when you're at that power output. Mm. So to then go off the front and drop 700 watts for 15 seconds and then just, you know, drop anchor is a little odd, but that's, like yeah, you say, that's panache. So
we're going to talk, I mean, maybe this is the opportunity now to talk about some of the performances based on some of the stuff we looked at, and Ross and I have been sharing screenshots from Strava of some of the athletes that we've been following, and Tadej Pogacar's performance over this last week, in particular at the Perisord. You know, I wanted to ask you, looking at the times of these guys, I don't want to bring up the bad old past of the Lance days, but how do the performances this year compare to the times that we saw in the Lance era?
The thing is, you can't not bring up the bad old days. And it's not just the Lance years. It's because Lance inherited it from Pantani and Festina and Rees and Ulrich and Veronk and all the guys before him, and they inherited it from someone before them. So you could it's dominoes, and you can just go further and further back, and you'll end up with Merckx. You'll end up in the very first one with guys who cheated by taking wine and strychnine to dull the pain. And
Simpson.
So you can't. That's Simpson. So you can't actually ignore it. And when I watch it now, and like, let's do this discussion because it is important. The names are different, but the patterns are the same. Dominant team, last 20 guys in the race, 6 of them are from one team. That's the situation as it's been since the turn of the century. Yeah. Except then it was Postal and it was being done for Lance. Then it became Sky and it was being done for Froome or Wiggins in the 1 year before. Mm. Then now it's Jumbo and it's being done for Roglic. So the patterns are the same.
Yeah.
It's very difficult to break the cynicism when not much has changed, yeah, and the guys in the cars are the guys who are on the bikes.
Yeah.
So why would you assume it to be different? Okay, now in 2006, the biological passport gets introduced and there is documented changes in the performance of the teams. There are documented changes in the blood profiles of the teams where there were indications that the passport was at least forcing a change in behavior. And so the backstory to performance analysis for me is in 2009, a journalist by the name of David Walsh is in South Africa. You cycling listeners will know this name because he's the guy who has, well, he did do a lot on Lance Armstrong's doping. He was one of a few journalists who really went hard after Lance. And in 2009, he was here in Cape Town because the British and Irish Lions rugby team were here and he was covering that tour. And I walked with him up the mountain. We did a hike on the mountain. And on that hike, I'll never forget, he told me, you need to look at the power outputs of these guys and their performances. Because what Lance is doing, remember this was as Lance was announcing his comeback. Uh-huh. What Lance and his guys did when he was winning his tours was physiologically impossible. And if you analyze the power, you'll see it. You'll figure out that they're doping based on their performance. And I was like, okay, I'm interested. I'll buy it. Yeah. Let me look into this.
So, this is the red flag to a sports scientist.
Yeah, it was. I mean, it was like, this is enticing. Can you spot a doper based on watts? Okay. Spoiler alert, no.
Okay, damn.
Yeah, unfortunately.
Okay.
At some theoretical point, you can, because it becomes eye-poppingly mutant.
Yeah.
Okay. But I'll tell you when that is. But what I then did was I got in touch with guys like Antoine Veyer, thorn in the side of Dave Brailsford and Sky, and most cyclists now, because he's an ultra cynic. He pretty much says all of it's mutant. And he was calculating power outputs, and he was saying mutant physiology if you were above 6.3 or something watts per kilogram, right?
Yeah.
And I started doing the same thing. And coincidentally, what happened in the 2009 tour was Alberto Contador wins a stage up to a ski resort called Verbier. And Greg LeMond gets hold of Contador's time on that climb. And I'll explain to you exactly how he does this. He says, well, based on how fast Contador climbed and the power output he produced, he has to have had a VO2 max of 100 mils per kilogram per minute. Like that's a headline. And I remember it was the headline. Le Monde, Contador VO2 max must be 100. Okay, this is interesting. So that, following David Walsh telling me to look at the power output, was kind of the...
So VO2 max, just to give some context to what you're saying, around 100, 100 is like maximum. So a good elite athlete would have a VO2 max of in this 80s.
Probably. Yeah, that would be exceptionally high. Okay. Anything between 72 and 85 would class you as being one of the world-class endurance athletes.
Because, and if you had 100, you'd be something wrong with you.
You'd be something wrong with your equipment if you were measuring that. So if I was measuring a guy and I saw 100, I'd say we need to recalibrate the machine.
Okay.
I'm sorry to waste your time, sir.
Okay. Right.
So there are, I mean, cross-country skiers, because they're using arm and legs, they get unbelievably high VO2 maxes. So it has been measured.
Mm.
But in a cyclist, it would be crazy high, you know, especially a climber like Contador, who's in theory also efficient. Because the more efficient you are, the less oxygen you use. That's the definition. And the less oxygen you use, the lower your max is.
Mm.
So the combination of a very efficient rider and a high VO2 max, that's alien or mutant. Right.
Okay.
So anyway, so I do an analysis of this Contador thing, and it put on my website. It becomes quite a talking point. It was cool. It attracted a lot of data guys, cycling anoreks. It was really interesting, I thought, at the time. And so begins this process where every year thereafter, we looked at the performances in the Tour de France. And we said, right, what's the power output for how long? What's the implication of that? And the reason, just for listeners and you, the reason this works is because cycling performance is really a consequence of three things. It's how big is the engine? That's VO2 max. How efficient is the engine? That's cycling efficiency.
So how big the engine is basically the number of cylinders in the engine. In other words, how big your lungs are and your blood capillaries. And
lungs and heart.
Yeah.
How well can that system do its job to get what's needed where it's needed?
Okay.
Oxygen and blood. So that's exactly what it is. So that's VO2 max engine. Number two is the efficiency. So in other words, the more efficient you are, the higher, the less energy you need at a submaximal speed. So it's almost like a fuel economy in a car, if we're going to stick to the engine analogy. Okay.
Yeah.
And then the third thing is your engine's ability to run at a high level for a long time. And that in physiology is lactate threshold or threshold. Let's just call it that.
Right.
Now, those three things are interlinked. They don't exist independent of one another. But if you know them, you can actually estimate performance, right? And if you don't know them, but you know performance, you can reverse engineer the physiology. So if we stick to the car analogy, and we may as well, if I'm standing on the side of the highway and a car comes by me and it's doing 350 kilometers an hour, there's no way that that's a Toyota Prius. Not possible.
Yeah.
Because the engine isn't large enough. The car just doesn't have the hardware to do that performance. Same thing with cycling. Is if you're going to produce 6.5 watts a kilogram for 45 minutes, you have to have a certain VO2 max, a certain efficiency, and a certain threshold ability.
Right.
If you didn't have one or all of those three things, you would not be capable of producing that power output.
Yeah.
So with that in mind, one can now start to look at Contador and Schleck and Rasmussen. Okay, that was a bit, it was after Rasmussen. And then you get into Wiggins, Nibali, Froome, Bernal, and so on. And you say, all right, what are these guys doing? And what are the implications of that? The problem is you have to make assumptions, you know, because a cyclist efficiency is between 21 and 25%. Where do you set it? It makes a big difference if he's 25% versus 21. Is his lactate threshold, his ability to sustain a given percentage of max for 25 minutes could be 85%, it could be 95%. So where do you set it? So There was a whole bunch of us. There was a guy called Mike, Dr. Mike Pukovitz in the States. There's a Finnish analyst who does it. I was trying to do it. Vaya was trying to do it. And we had a lot of fun actually doing it for 5 or 6 years.
Mm.
I was eventually asked to write a piece in the New York Times. And I remember the conclusion from that piece in 2011 was that the indications are that the Tour de France is slower than it was during the peak doping days of Pantani, Ulrich, Rees, Armstrong. So you could have, at that point, you could divide cycling up into unregulated, unmitigated doping in the 90s.
Mm-hmm.
Then you had a period of Armstrong where we know there was doping, but it was intelligent doping. Then there was the biological passport watershed where performances did slow down. There's no doubt that in the 4 or 5 years after the biological passport, they got slower.
Mm.
And then from 2012, it starts getting faster and faster again. And bringing us to this year's tour, the times we saw on the Paris Sword and yesterday on the Marie Blanc, or Sunday for those listening to it on Tuesday, were faster than anything that's been done in history. Now, cue debate. Because if Walsh's argument is that you can catch a doper because he's producing power outputs that are so high, and that others are saying, well, look, doping must be getting less because the speeds are getting lower, well, then by the same logic, the faster than ever performances mean what?
Yeah, but there's lots of variables because it depends on whether that effort from Pogacar, for instance, on the Saturday at the Paris Sword, it was a solo effort maximum the whole way, whereas if the a group of riders are attacking each other and slowing down, it's not a sustained effort. So there's, it's not an absolute to suggest that a good time up a climb is necessarily suspicious.
And so that's why in the end, I stopped writing about this because so many people misunderstood the whole point of this exercise was, and I remember writing, please do not fall prey to what I called performance pixelation. You know, if you ever go to the Louvre and you're facing the Mona Lisa, it's a tiny little thing on the wall. If you turn around, there's a much more impressive painting behind you. It's the Wedding Feast at Cana, I think. Mm. Have you been there?
No.
Anyway, it's massive. It's like floor to ceiling, wall to wall. It's big. What I'm saying is that if you stand 5 centimeters from that painting, you see nothing. There's no value in looking at a painting from 5 centimeters away.
Right.
Because all you can see is one blotch of paint. Yes. One pixel on the screen.
Yeah, this is a nice art analogy.
From cars to art. So what you have to do if you want to appreciate the whole thing is you have to take 10 steps back and look at it from afar. And then you can see the whole thing collectively. And what I was saying was, let's take a look at the whole thing from afar and not focus on the Contador climb of Verbier, not focus on the Rasmussen ascent of the Tourmalet, or in that particular year, in 2010, I think it was Contador Schleck on the Tourmalet. Let's not do that for Froome on Axtra Domain. Let's not do it for Pogacar and Roglic on Col Marie Blanc yesterday. But I think that you can collectively step back and say at the end of a tour and at the end of a generation, what are the patterns that we're seeing? And so that's where I think it starts to become valuable. But as you have correctly said, there are things that are changing other than doping, you know. So the race profile changes.
Yeah.
Maybe the Paris Sword has never been done on the fifth day of the tour, sixth day, whatever it was, on the Tour de France.
It's slightly fresher.
It's normally on the 15th day. And so so all these things start to factor in. So don't get stuck on one performance. But you see, the cynic in me finds it difficult to break from what I'm seeing as a pattern. And that's not targeted at one guy or anything. It's just It's just the whole thing. The whole sport just seems to still just be repeating a pattern.
Yeah. I mean, I guess, you know, because you're looking at the stuff all the time, there is always that temptation to look at the numbers and to look at something, you know. I'd imagine if they did a time trial up the Tourmalet every year or every second year, and then you worked out who got the best time of that Tourmalet, you could then track performances more absolutely rather than what you can do now when you're basing it on a time of the tour and also basing it on the tactics of the day and that sort of thing. So it is difficult.
So there is
no real way of testing. I mean, we can suspect and we can certainly be cynical about it, but there's no proof based on a performance up a particular climb.
Eventually my conclusion. And I mean, I remember writing that at the start. Can you spot a doper from performance? Well, no, of course not, because there are too many moving parts and too many factors. If a guy rides 7 watts a kilo for 45 minutes, I'm calling shenanigans on it 100% confidently.
Yeah.
If I know that his power was 7 watts a kilogram for 45 minutes, it's physically impossible physiologically impossible for that person to do it as a member of the human race. So I'm calling him as an alien or a doper.
Why do we know that?
Because the combination of VO2 max and efficiency and ability to sustain lactate just does not exist in a human being at that level.
Yeah.
And that's 7-8 watts a kilo. I mean, you know, Pogacar and Parasaud uploads his Strava file, which is great, by the way. When we were doing this in 2009, 10, 11, we did not get power data from cyclists.
Yeah.
Now you're starting to, I think it's cool.
It's great.
I remember at the time we used to say, like, one of the things to improve trust in cycling would be give people the power data.
Yes.
Because people understood. I mean, people weren't stupid. Some are.
Yes.
But people understand, like, what they're looking at if they're really passionate and interested in it. They'd be able to figure it out. So give it to them instead of letting them guess it plus or minus 4%. Because the plus 4% makes it look alien and the minus 4% makes it look normal. Mm. So why would you not give the guy accurate data if you think it's normal? Anyway, so at seven watts a kilo for 45 minutes to an hour, it's just not possible. I mean, I can.
What's Pogacar doing at Parasaud, for instance?
So that was 25. That was 25 minutes at 6.5 watts a kilo, if his mass on Strava is accurate. So it's 25.
Because he's
minutes.
A relatively heavy guy, if you compare him to Yates and Bernal.
Yeah, so he looks taller than many of them. I mean, Bernal's in the 50s, isn't he?
Or
52,
actually.
Yeah. Roglic and Pogacar are probably similar in mass.
I'm going to look it up now on the Google Nets.
Go for it. But I'll give you, let me give you an example of how this plays out. We'll do it for you. So your mass is?
95.
Okay, 95. So
why did you have to ask me that?
Well,
can we just use a fictitious person like John?
Because in the name of transparency, we're not hiding anything from our listeners.
Why can we use your weight?
So then what we need to do is we need to say, right, what's your efficiency? Now, we know that elite cyclists are 23 to 25. Lance Armstrong was measured in a famous paper by Coyle at 23.5%. Papers are published where they document some guys at 25 to 26%. Contentiously, most of them are below 25, somewhere between 22 and 25. So I'll set you up at 22%, right? Let's just make that assumption. Now, we also know from your Strava rides and so on that your FTP, let's say at the moment, is, just for ease of calculation, 280 watts, which is a shade under 3 watts a kilogram, okay?
That's about right.
Yeah. Now, what that means at that efficiency, and assuming that you're working at that intensity for 45 minutes, remember, that's by definition what you would do for 45 minutes to an hour is your critical power.
Right.
So for listeners who haven't yet listened to our FTP one.
Which is the same as critical power.
More or less, give or take.
What I can hold for an hour.
Yeah. And so that is your semi-steady state sustainable power output. Any harder than that, fatigue happens quickly.
Mm-hmm.
Any slower than that, you can go much longer distances. So it's kind of like your threshold sustainable power. What we'd work out for you is that at that power output, given where your energy is coming from and your efficiency, your VO2 at that moment would be 38 mils of oxygen per kilogram per minute. That's your VO2 at that power.
Right.
Now, if we assume
bloody impressive, eh?
That you are capable of, and this is a reasonable assumption for an amateur athlete. The pros obviously can go much higher than that. If we assume that you're capable of holding 75% of your max for an hour, which is I'd say it's reasonable.
Yeah, should be.
It predicts
that
your VO2 max would be 51. And I would take a fairly safe bet with you that if we were to go down the road here and test your VO2 max, you'd be within a couple of mils of that value. 51.
2 years ago, it was 56.
2 years ago?
Yeah.
Were you fitter then or?
Fitter now.
Are you?
I think, yeah.
Okay.
But I'm older.
True. Only a couple of years.
Yeah.
So it would be interesting to check.
Yeah.
So if we take Pogacar, sure. So 65 kilos.
Okay, so here we go. I got the numbers. Pogacar 66, Bernal is 60.
Okay, so 66. We're going to see. So for Pogacar, we're assuming high efficiency.
Right.
Cycling efficiency is a big unknown, by the way, but we'll just assume 24%. We know that he averaged 428 watts on that Parasaud climb. That gives him 6.5 watts per kilo. I mean, these are huge numbers. Oh. Unbelievable. That predicts that at that moment, his VO2 on the Parasaud would have been in the mid-70s, 76.
Which is feasible.
So he's riding it for 25 minutes. So if you assume that he can hold 95% for 25 minutes, his VO2 max would be 81. If you assume that he's riding at 90%, his VO2 max is 85. So yes, it is feasible. It's physiologically plausible. It's exceptionally high, but I mean, the guy's like winning the Tour de France. Obviously, yeah. It's going to be. You're not going to be on the front of the Tour de France if you're mediocre.
Sure.
If we were to make his VO2 max, his power output 510, so now he's at 7.7. Now his predicted VO2 max is well over 100. Or we have to make his efficiency like 30% in order for his VO2 max to look reasonable. That's why I said it's not plausible.
Right.
Does that make sense? So there comes a point at which you cross over into clearly unphysiological performances. Mm. They aren't there, but they are in a point where it's very gray. So if we had red, orange, and green, they're all orange.
All orange, yeah.
And so again, performance alone does not tell you if someone is doping. That's the point we try to make all along. But the patterns and there's lots of reasons to be cynical, and performance might be considered to be one of them, but it's not, if I'm a judge and that's the evidence, I'm not reaching a guilty verdict.
And I mean, in defense of cycling and cyclists, I mean, nobody's going to go out and ride a stage of the Tour de France and hold back to try and make sure their numbers look right. I mean, if and I'd imagine trying to take something that just gives you that added bonus just to keep you inside some sort of reasonable limit also is quite almost impossible to do. So
no, I mean, it is what it is.
So, this is all feasible, but also grey.
Yeah, so there would have been 10 guys yesterday all within 0.2 watts per kilogram one another. So for context, on Alpe d'Huez, which is the most famous climb perhaps, ridden incredibly frequently, so you've got a lot of data on Alpe d'Huez. The times of the 1990s and the early 2000s were regularly under 40 minutes, and that corresponds to 6 to 6.4 watts per kilogram for 40 minutes of riding.
Right.
In the years after the passport, those performances slowed down. As I've said, they were outside 40 minutes for the first time in many years, and they were between 5.9 and 6.2 watts per kilogram for 40 minutes. So that would seem to me now, on those long 40-plus minute climbs, the Tourmalet, Alpe d'Huez, Mont Ventoux would be another one like that.
Mm.
6 to 6.2 would be what I would expect is the limit for what it takes to win at the front of the Tour de France. If I'm seeing 6.5 for 45 minutes, that's going to set alarm bells off, for sure. It's not impossible, but it's highly improbable without some assistance. So the tour got slower and it's now gotten faster. And then you have bike technology, people will say, and there's lots of things people will argue have contributed to it. I still think that it's such a pity that we didn't have accurate performance data going back to the mid-90s, because I think it would tell a story better than what we can tell with our estimations that we're forced to make for 15 years until now.
So just give us a little bit of let's say there's armchair scientists that are out there and want to kind of do some of the anorak work while they're watching the tour. Just give us those, how you would work it out. Where can people go to sort of work out numbers? You can easily find out what somebody's weight is online and figure it out. And is there a resource you can point us to?
Or there's a few websites.
Or some you can do it with?
If you know the power output and the weight, then those
you can look on Strava for lots of those.
Yeah, and a lot of guys are uploading this.
Yeah, but not their heart rates, ironically.
Yeah, we'll get to that. So you need to know efficiency. And there's two assumptions, really. It's efficiency and percentage of maximum. Those are the only
And efficiency is not really measurable, is it?
It's not measurable, accurate. Well, it's not knowable. It's measurable if you've got the guy in a lab.
Is there a number? Is there like... his efficiency is 9 bits?
No, well, it's between 21 and 25%.
Okay.
For an elite cyclist. That's just the proportion of all your energy that's actually going into useful work.
Okay, I'm with you.
So there's much of it's lost to heat and so on, right? That's where the other 75% of it goes.
So if you're riding into a headwind, you lose a lot of efficiency on environmental issues or
no,
not.
So that's no, because the efficiency calculation is based on actual work done on the bike.
Okay.
Then so it gets even more complex. Then the bike has to do work on the environment.
Right.
And that's where a headwind, So if you didn't have a direct measure of power and you had to estimate it, a headwind would cause you to underestimate the power and a tailwind would cause you to overestimate it, because yes. you'd be basing your performance on an artificially faster or slower time, yes. depending on which direction the wind was coming
and
from.
And if there's a big tailwind going up the parasword.
And that was one of the things that was now discussed. And then even with Contador in 209, you know, it was a tailwind on the Verbier. So he climbed at 45 seconds faster. Therefore, by inference or implication rather, the power output would have been a little bit faster than it would have been had they not been.
Actual power wouldn't have been.
Actual power would have been the same, but it looks faster because of the tailwind. So it got dicey for all those reasons. And like no one, you know, Mike and I and all the guys, we were open about these limitations.
Yeah.
Which is the reason you shouldn't look at one pixel, because one pixel
was
subject to error. And the whole picture, Mike did some really cool stuff where he was comparing the doping era to the non, in theory, non-doped era, and predicting what they'd do the climbs in before and seeing whether he was accurate and whether they're faster or not. And it was a cool era and phase, but it just got exhausting because people just reacted to it as though you were saying the guy was so fast he must be doping. And we're not in that range of performances yet. We are close to it. And again, in the absence of any other context, you know, or in the absence of any other changes in cycling, I'm still skeptical, but it's not by itself the smoking gun.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
So is there such a thing as a forensic sports scientist?
Well, there was for those
years. It sounds
years.
Like and there then, could be.
And then Brailsford called it pseudoscience, and Wiggins called it something not repeatable on air. And that was the kind of stuff that was happening. You know, it was funny because we were just trying to have a discussion. And other sports scientists, there's a French guy called Frédéric Grappa who was getting involved. And then, as you know, Froome eventually got tested. I think he tested before the Vuelta. And so we saw some of his physiology. It didn't explain the transformation, but it was still interesting to see. And Thibaut Pinot used to publish his training performances and his race performances. I was a sucker for transparency. So I used to think if the guy was transparent, he must have less to hide.
Yeah.
This probably isn't the case. But I think there is a place for it. And, you know, I've got a colleague, a guy called Sergei Ilyukov, who's more into the running. He has documented running performances, times, in the Russian athletes before and after the whole Russian doping house of cards fell. And so he's shown that Russian doping was probably responsible for their performances in the early part of the 2000s. And then there's a watershed. The biological passport stuff I mentioned showed it the same way. So if you're systematic about it and you understand the limitations, I think that performance analysis does contribute to understanding doping, but they weren't systematic about it, and we weren't systematic enough about it, and wasn't controlled enough. So it became maybe too much assumption based and too distracting, because now one outlier performance was offered without context, and it became in the end quite tiring to do, you know. And I remember doing it with Nibali's performances. Same conclusion. He's deep in the gray or the orange. He's very close to the human limits of performance. Not a peep. The moment you did it about a British cyclist, my goodness. it was savage.
How dare you?
Exactly. Now I wonder, like, if we did it about Slovenians, I mean, I suppose they'd be upset. Yeah. But no one in England's asking the question anymore.
And nobody in Slovenia bothers about the English media.
Or criticizing. Either. Yeah, it's quite funny to look at. I mean, and it was the same with in the 90s and 2000s with Lance. Like, the American media were very protective.
Yeah.
And David Walsh and the French were being accused of being just hating on Americans.
Yeah.
And then it just changed. So the flag changes, but the conversation doesn't. Mm-hmm. The pattern repeats.
Well, let's hope our cynicism isn't clouding your enjoyment of our podcast today or your enjoyment of the rest of the tour. We're going to move on from the cynicism a little bit and just talk a little bit about some of the numbers around the sprint analysis. And that this is an interesting place because it's kind of the opposite of what we're talking about in terms of your your vertical ascent measurements or your VAMs. This is all about how fast you can go. And I think what's really fascinating about this discussion is comparing a guy like Alexander Kristoff, who is a fairly big chap, versus a relatively small sprinter like Caleb Ewan. Mm. They've obviously got to push out a huge amount of power, but I'm always quite surprised that a guy like Caleb Ewan, I mean, he sort of squeezes in between people's, thighs. He's so small, but he has a, it's very rare to see a small sprinter being so, where is it actually? The more I think about it, I think about Cavendish and I think about some of the Australian, Robbie McEwen and all those kind of guys. I suppose they were all quite small. It feels like sprinting maybe doesn't have a body type. It has a muscle type.
Yeah, let's say that there's an interaction. How's that for sitting on the fence? There's an interaction between body type and muscle.
Sorry, I just changed my mind about something halfway through my first sentence, so you can do whatever you like.
That's good. I mean, like you start exploring a thing and you suddenly realize actually the facts don't match my hypothesis. Yeah. And now my hypothesis has just changed.
You think Cipollini.
You think like Tor Hushovd. I mean, Hushovd looked, he was... Yeah. So obviously, at the extremes, what you've just said is true. So like the track sprinter is a massive guy.
They're big fellas, yeah.
I mean, these are guys, and they are hitting 2,000 watts. That's
who's got the best power output in cycling? What particular discipline? I saw a YouTube video about this the other day. BMXs.
Oh, yeah.
They push out more watts than even the track cyclists because they need to push out 3 seconds of, and they're pushing out 2,600 watts.
At the gate. First few seconds.
Yeah. That's unbelievable.
So I have actually seen that. It's over 2,000. We had a guy never won the Olympic medal, did he? Sofisa Ntlapo.
South African. He didn't.
He was ranked top three going into the Olympics. Right. He might have got injured anyway. I forget.
But what it does is it shows you think about the sprinters of the Tour de France being the power kings of cycling, but they're not even on the same ballpark.
They're endurance athletes with the high end. That's what they are. And so sprints are really interesting. So the one thing to start with is that there's actually a very poor correlation between power output and finishing position in a sprint. Right. So in other words, the guy who produces the watts is not always going to win. So for instance, across, and this is a study, so just context here, 2014 I attended a Tour de France conference in Leeds. I spoke at it, and so did another guy called Paolo Manaspa, who's now head of performance solutions for Australian cycling. Lovely guy, look him up. I think his Twitter handle is ManaspaP, at ManaspaP. You can have a look for him. I don't know if he listens to this pod. If he does, hey, Paolo. So I spoke to him after his talk. I said, that was really interesting, because he presented a whole analysis of the sprint, which is, we discussed climbing all the time, but no one really looks at the sprint. And they did. And they found a bunch of sprinters and they tracked them over like 2 or 3 years. And they looked at the sprints where these guys finished in the top five. So successful sprints. Obviously winning it is successful. Who came second on stage one? Yeah. Who knows? And what they found is that sometimes the guy winning it produces 1,400 watts. Other times the guy at 1,400 watts comes third. And the guy who won the sprint produced 1,100 watts. So what does that tell you? It tells you that there's a significant contribution of aerodynamics and there's a significant contribution of tactical nous to the sprint. Because those 1,400 watts could have come 90 meters from the finish line and that was the wrong time to apply that power. Whereas the 1,100 might have been just at the right time. So that's really interesting. So average power in the sprint in this study, 1,250, ranging from 980 all the way to 1,500.
Right.
With no relationship between power and finishing position, which tells you that the ability to get speed out of a given power is maybe the key thing.
And what about power versus a person's size?
Person's weight.
Yeah.
So, and their size is going to influence in part their aerodynamic frontal surface area. Because we're assuming a sprint's on a flat road, so you're not having to work against gravity.
Mm-hmm.
So really the contribution of size is how quickly can you accelerate, but they're accelerating from 60 to 68, 73.
Yes, they're not doing it standstill.
Yeah, so it's not really a standing. So it's not really a Newton's law of motion thing. It is, but not quite like that. So it's the head down, shoulders down position, That's communication from David Martin, who's also a physiologist who studied this, as typified by Cavendish, you know, that famous low position, chin's on front of the handlebar, and his shoulders are basically at the height of his handlebars.
Mm. So it's very difficult to sprint like that, so it's a proper skill.
Yeah, and that's similar to what Caleb Ewan was producing in that particular sprint. So those are the elements. It's the tactical positioning, it's the timing of the sprint, it's your ability to produce power, and it's the ability to turn power into speed as a consequence of being less wind resistant or lowering your aerodynamic drag. And then, of course, if you can produce the same power at 68 kilograms compared to 78, that's going to help you because your size is smaller. But it's, for the most part, it's a function of power and aerodynamics.
Yeah.
Not necessarily just mass per se.
Yeah. I mean, if you watch, I mean, the Caleb Ewan, when he won the stage in this first week, I can't remember what stage it was. I think three or might even been one. I can't remember now. But I mean, he came literally from nowhere through a gap that didn't exist.
Well, he slalomed. It was a remarkable incredible skill.
It's one of those things when you watch sprinting. I never used to enjoy the sprint stages because I always felt they weren't as dramatic as watching the climbs. But there's no doubt that I've learned to enjoy them probably as much as I enjoyed the stages, because you just see the tactical nuance. And I always am amazed by how some teams dedicate so many resources to being in the front of the bunch with 5Ks to go. And then suddenly that team's gone in the last kilometer and some other team's in the front. So there's chance involved in that, I imagine. There's skill, there's a fair amount of luck, I would imagine, just trying to win a stage, because, you know, probably the top five in the world on a good day could win at any stage, but they just get lucky.
Though it is the top five. So one of the interesting things in that study was, and I just want to find it so that I don't quote it incorrectly to you, quite a remarkable stat is that, I just want to find it for you because I was blown away by it. And this is obviously dated a little bit now. The names might have changed, but this was this is from about 2009 to 2013. 79 stages finished in a sprint, and 54 of them were shared between five sprinters. So there is a very select group of people who, A, can, and B, choose to try and contest those stage finishes.
Yeah.
But then there is luck. I mean, we saw the other day, like Sagan gets a bump, he drops the chain, Alaphilippe gets bumped, and then that's because at that speed, like the slightest loss of momentum and you're passed by six people within 20 meters. So
that's incredible.
What I've always found with a sprint is they're frantic. It's very difficult to know what you're watching.
Yeah.
But the post-analysis of the sprint really like makes them very interesting. And where the coverage, I think, has become quite good is they now have that little digital thing where they actually, from the aerial shot, overlay.
Yeah.
Here's Sagan, here's Ewan, here's Wout van Aert, whatever it is. And that certainly makes it a lot more relatable, and you can appreciate it much more. So I'm like you. I'm becoming more fond of them.
Yeah. Then, it is interesting.
And then when you see, I mean, you see the – it doesn't look risky, but then when you see the consequences of mistakes.
Yes.
So, I mean, this wasn't the Tour de France, but the crash that – what's the guy's name? Grunewald was the guy who bumped him.
That wasn't Grunewald. Grunewald was the one that
– he was the culprit, quote-unquote, who bumped the guy, and he hit the sideboards in Poland, was it?
All the Tour of Poland, I think. The cycling fans are going to go, I know who he is. We'll call it.
But, I mean, cheapers, you see that. Do you remember the crash of Jamaluddin Abdujabarov on the Champs-Élysées where the photographer, the policeman leaned out and
And he hit a Coke, the Coke can. Well, it wasn't an actual can. It was kind of a Coke symbol on the side of it, and he hit it extremely hard.
But I mean, it's just like metal and bodies, eh?
I was just going to say my favorite name in cycling is Jamaluddin Abdujabarov. 80s?
80s, 90s, because I remember him, and I really only got into cycling like 92, 93. Yeah. So
he was the original superstar with Cipollini.
And I mean, you remember that look at that footage, and they weren't even wearing helmets.
Yeah, it's nuts.
Wow. So it's crazy. I mean, I was watching actually even in the tour coverage now, they show flashbacks, and they showed the other day Ulrich and who was it who held off to win the race? It was a French cyclist. I forget the guy's name. Laurent Brossard, I think it was.
Mm-hmm.
And they finished down this climb. And, I mean, no helmets.
Yeah.
They go, not even on the descents.
This is controversial, though, but I know that everybody involved in cycling will probably shoot me down as editors of bicycling. I shouldn't be saying this. But I would be interested to know how helmets do. I remember this as a podcast somewhere down the line about do helmets actually make that much difference? I mean, yes, of course, if you fell on your head and you haven't got a helmet on, you're likely to injure yourself. But how many people, you know, you look at those pros, yes, people die, Cassidelli died. You know, there has been a number of deaths that probably could have prevented from helmets. But I suppose there's no harm in wearing them, so why not wear them, I guess?
Yeah. I mean, what's the downside is camera friendliness.
Yeah. Yeah. I still think they should be able to not wear them on the hills, but anyway.
I suppose it makes it difficult. Jacobsen.
There we go.
Fabio Jacobsen. And yeah, Dylan Groenewegen was the guy who bumped him to the right and he hit the boards and they just came apart and he went into a spectator. And I don't even know what the status of those people is now. I'll look it up at the end of this, but...
Yeah.
But yeah, so yeah, helmets.
I mean, they were criticized because of the state of the boards along the finishing straight, particularly on the tour, that they weren't upright boards. They were slightly leaned over. So when he hit them, he just took them out and they didn't have enough structure to them. And of course, the Tour de France, those boards are literally straight up and they can actually, you can hit those boards at a fair amount of speed and they won't fall apart. So protecting the spectators mainly.
So helmets, I'll say that if in the event that a guy falls and he's going to hit his head on the ground, I mean, skull fractures, they'll prevent that.
For sure.
They don't prevent concussions. You know, we have this debate in rugby all the time, like should they wear headgear? Well, they don't prevent that. And there's interesting data, actually, that you get more risk-taking behavior when you wear them than without. And I've seen similar things from cycling. I don't know if it's a legit thing or if it was just a theory, but someone was saying that a cyclist with a helmet will take a risk causing an accident, whereas a cyclist without one will be more cautious. And so what you gain from the helmet, you might actually lose from the risk-taking behaviors. And I don't know if that's ever been studied systematically. Well,
there's all these new technologies in helmets now, the MIPS technology, which is a helmet within a helmet. So supposedly that is meant to counteract the idea that you can get concussion because it sort of absorbs the shock in the inside of the helmet. But
maybe who knows whether it's good marketing. There's a talk by a neuroscience guy from, I think, Stanford. It's a TEDx talk. You can look it up, TEDx helmets concussion, you'll find it. And he's got a video in there. This will never take on, but it's basically like a neck thing that you wear and it's an airbag. Have you
seen
it? And like, so they've got this video of the guy and he hits a curb or something and he goes over the front. He's over the front of the handlebars and as he launches, some accelerometer thing mobilizes this thing and he lands on what's basically a little airbag helmet. It looks ridiculous.
Just make a whole body one, just full. Yeah. And you can roll down a hill whenever you feel like it.
Anyway, so I can't complain about the helmets. Yeah. I think it's necessary.
Okay, so now the big thing we're going to be talking about, and I always hate doing this because in a couple of weeks' time we might be shot down for knowing nothing about anything. But let's just talk about some of the predictions now, because obviously there are some big stages to come. We will probably do a wrap-up of the tour in the next couple of weeks, and we hope that it will continue the time of listening to this podcast. Hopefully you will be watching the next stage. But it looks to me, just based on the stuff that we've seen, there is a youngster by the name of Tadej Pogacar who's going to be a big threat to the overall contenders. My contention is that he is probably the biggest threat to Roglic, but I think that Bernal, with experience, will probably get stronger. And Roglic still sits there as the favorite based on the fact that he has the strongest team and looks the most composed.
Yeah, I think that for Roglic to not be the favorite, you've got to place a bet that something's going to change.
Yeah.
His form has to drop or Bernal has to get much better. It's difficult to see Pogacar being much better in week three than he is now. At best, he stays at this level.
Yeah.
Which means that if Roglic doesn't drop his level, Roglic wins the tour.
Yeah.
And if Bernal can't raise his level, Roglic wins the tour.
So Bernal needs to take some time up in the climbs.
Yeah, and he might, because now we head obviously to the Alps and they don't have the massive Alp days where they hit 2,500 meters and so on like usual, but they do have some pretty high days in the Alps. Mm. We haven't seen a 2,000 meter climb in this tour so far, and that can play a role, right? Because with altitude, performance capacity drops because your VO2 max drops by, I think, 1% for every 100 meters that you go up. And so what you see in the relatively mid-altitude Pyrenean climbs sometimes looks a little bit different when you start getting into the very thin air of the Alps. So that's interesting. And you know Bernal is the Colombians at the altitude birth, not just birth, altitude ancestry.
Yeah.
There's good reason in physiology to think that being third, fourth, fifth, sixth generation at altitude is different from being sea level who trains at altitude. So that's an unknown, I think, at this point.
Yeah.
Bernal, after Saturday, I saw Quintana and I'm like, oh, this is cool. The guy looks actually very sharp. He covered the moves very well. He threw an attack of his own, which is like once every 5 years that Quintana feels like he attacks in the Tour. I've always waited for Quintana to be a little more aggressive, and Saturday did it, and then Pogacar shut him down real quick. But still, this is good. Then yesterday he couldn't follow the moves. So is he going? You know, so what's so interesting is like there's trajectories. Who's on an upward and who's on a downward and who's holding?
Yeah.
Roglic seems to me to be holding. Yes. And the concern is that he's been holding since racing started post-COVID, which was, when was that? I mean, that was in early July. Late July.
Yeah, he won the Slovakian championships and beat Pogacar actually in those championships, didn't he?
Pogacar beat him in the time trial. I know that.
Yes, but he won the road race.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
I thought he beat them in the time trial.
So they're
well,
very well matched, those two. Which tells you that maybe people who didn't look at Pogacar were maybe discounting the guy a little. But Bernal, I think, is yesterday suggests to me that Bernal's on an up. Because he looked better yesterday than he'd looked in the previous days, for sure. And having gone through like the back issues, I mean, with time, is that going to get better? Is he the guy who's going to be? But I think Roglic hangs on just enough. And I also think because the final key decisive day in the Tour is a time trial, it's an uphill time trial.
Yeah.
But I still think Roglic has a slight time trialing advantage over Bernal. So unless Pogacar can do something, I still see going Roglic, Bernal, Pogacar by the podium in Paris.
I want to stick my neck out and I'm going to say Pogacar for the win, because I think he can time trial as well, and I think it'll suit him. I think he'll beat Roglic in the time trial, in the uphill time trial, but we'll see.
The thing for Pogacar, the concern would be like Thursday he lost the time, he lost the group at the front.
And he doesn't have the team either. Same level.
So it was apparently a puncture, and he'd just come on at the back of the front. That's when the split happened and he couldn't make the first group.
Mm.
But then he worked hell of a hard. The report was that he was pulling on the front of that second chase group so hard, more than anyone else.
Yeah.
So that's a hard day Thursday, was it?
Yeah, but he was strong.
Then Saturday he's doing, I mean, the hardest ride he's probably done. He's attacking on the parasword. Then on Sunday he's doing another incredibly, like, how many matches can you burn before you have a bad day? So that's the concern, is that he's, because they always used to say, you know, spend your effort, like four big efforts in the Tour de France.
I don't know who said it on Twitter, but it was a great tweet that I saw on my feed today. It says, Pogacar has burnt one of his 1,813 matches again.
So, and maybe that's the case. Maybe that happens. Yeah, and I mean, you never know. Like rest days, there's a big potentially crosswind day tomorrow on the coast, and maybe the whole race gets turned on its head because someone loses time. Does Jumbo have the ability to set the pace and to hold the race? Mm. put a noose around the racer's neck. By the way, physiologically, can we just talk about what they're doing?
Let's do it. That's why we do this podcast.
Again, I'm referring back to our What the FTP show that we did. The top 20 or 30 cyclists in the world are fairly similarly matched. I mean, not identical, obviously. Otherwise, it would be a dead heat every race. But fairly similarly matched in terms of what they are able to do for 30 to 60 minutes. That's called CP, FTP, MLSS. They vary slightly, but that's what it is. What Jumbo are doing when they have Gesink on the front for 2K, then Wout van Aertx over for 3K, then in theory it's Bennett or Sepp Kuss doing it for 2 or 3K, is they are riding at a pace that puts the entire group, the front group, pretty much on or just below that MLSS power output. So if Quintana and Bernal could do, you said Bernal was 60 Ks.
60, yeah.
So let's say Bernal can do 380 watts for 30 minutes. That's his limit. They want him to be riding at 370, 380 watts for those first 5 or 6K of a climb. Because what that's doing for Bernal is he's so close to his critical power that if he tried to attack, he would now be in that anaerobic component of his work capacity, the so-called W prime. So now he starts to use his battery up. And so they're saying, okay, fine, go for it. If you want to go for it with this tempo, that's fine, but we know that it's not sustainable for you. We're placing that bet. We don't know it. We're placing a bet. And so if you go, we'll just nudge it up 1 or 2% because you cannot sustain 400. That's our play here. The same thing for Quintana. They're saying you can ride 380. We accept that, but you cannot go to 400.
Yeah.
Because now you're going to start going above CP, power output wise. The moment you're above CP, you have to access energy from other sources, and that leads to rapid fatigue. And so that's basically what they're doing. They're strangling the race. It's the same method of Postal, it's the same method of Sky, and it's now the method of Jumbo-Visma.
An interesting one on that one is where Adam Yates is riding at the moment, isn't he? Because he's kind of just almost time trialing himself up climbs and not responding to any of the racing.
And there's always one. So Yates was a great example Saturday. Yesterday, it was just too much for him. I just don't think he had the condition to race for yellow. Richie Port yesterday was your example of that, because there's always one, by the way. Watch this, listeners. You'll always see one guy drop off when there's an attack, and 2 minutes later, he's back. Mm. Then there's a counterattack. He drops off. He comes back.
Yeah. Martin does that a lot.
And that's your barometer for what's actually happening. So that guy, he's not riding steady pace, but he's probably riding at his critical power plus or minus 2%. So 400 watts plus or minus 10 watts, let's say, for argument's sake, right?
Yeah.
What Pogacar, what Roglic, what Quintana and Bernal are doing is they're going 400 to 450 for a short time. I mean, Pogacar's attacks were 700 watts.
Yeah.
For 10 seconds, then we settle back down. Then we go up again, then we come back down. And so their power variation is much more volatile than Yates or Port, or yesterday Bardet did it, where he lost the first move and then he comes back to it. Because whether by physiological design or choice, they don't have the capacity to pick it up by 30% for a short time, because they don't want to access that battery, that W prime. So there's always one who tells you that. So if you want to gauge what the top guys are doing, look at what the fifth, sixth, and seventh guy is doing, because he gives you the context for what's happening at the front.
I mean, you see those guys coming back. That's probably the overall average speed that those guys are going. I mean, Dumoulin's probably quite a good example of somebody who rides a climb fairly consistently, although he's now a Tomistique.
Normally, yes. But like in this race, he's actually been thrown out there to just hammer it. And it was interesting. One of the first cyclists who ever made his power output data available, I remember it because back in the day when we were doing this, we were so hungry for actual files, was Chris Anker Sorensen. And he was riding for Andy Schleck. And I remember I think it was the Tourmalet. He hits the first 21 minutes at 6.6 watts a kilo, which is huge numbers.
Yeah.
And then he pops off and he just, you know, you've seen them. They just peel off to the side
and they're going to hardly pedal.
And they hardly pedal and they just cruise up, which for them is cruising. For us, it's like still way beyond max. But what's really interesting is that the overall pace slows down when he drops off.
Yes.
So the hardest part of the climb is the bit that's being led out by the team. And then once that goes, now it becomes much more stochastic, because it's 750 watts for 10 seconds from Pogacar. The moment they're on his wheel, we drop it down to 280 watts for another 20, 30 seconds. And so you get this yo-yoing of power output. Meanwhile, Bardet, Yates, Port, they're not playing the 700, 200 game. They're playing a 400 game.
Yeah.
And so they actually reveal to you what's actually happening with the top guys. So they're always useful to watch.
I know that we were going to talk about this pre-podcast. I don't think we're going to get to it today. And it's something we can look at potentially for a podcast after the tour. But I'm always fascinated by the idea of your mind or the motivation being able to overcome some of the physiology. I mean, we look at the performances. If we look at a guy like Yates and Richie Port and those kind of guys, and you say they know what they can go up a climb at a certain speed, they know that all the riders that are in a similar category, they know what they can do. They know if somebody goes off the front, they're going to come back to some extent. How much can somebody be motivated to overstep that physiology that surprises everybody? I don't know whether there's a quick answer to that, but that's always a good question. Pogacar is clearly a guy who's got a lot of desire, a lot of passion. And I wonder how much that would help him overcome some of the physiological limits that are there.
Yeah.
If they are overcomable.
The corollary is that if you're not motivated, then you don't access your physiological capacity. That's obvious, I would hope. Does it necessarily follow that a highly motivated guy can go beyond physiological capacity? No, because that's not truly capacity then. So the physiological capacity is set.
But you and I have good days on a bike. I had a terrible day on Friday. I wasn't feeling great. didn't ride particularly well. Yesterday I had a good day.
Yeah, so like the physiological capacity might vary from one day to the next. Mm. But I still don't think that on any given day, in any given context, motivation can override it. It's the same thing. I've always said, like, nobody in history has ever successfully committed suicide holding their breath. Doesn't matter how badly you want to go.
Yeah.
The body has a failsafe that will stop you from that stupidity before you can succeed. And it's the same. Like, there is a limit imposed by physiology that no degree of motivation can overcome. So yesterday when Hershey summits with 13 seconds and he then grows that lead on the descent because he's taking all kinds of risks that the favorites aren't.
Mm.
That lead is, 27 seconds at most?
Yeah.
With four or five K to go.
Yeah.
Then the road flattens out and maybe tilts slightly up. And suddenly now he has to find physiology that he just doesn't have at the end of a long, hard day. And that lead starts coming down and down and down. You can't tell me with 4Ks to go that that guy's not as motivated as a human being has ever been to stay ahead of the group, but he couldn't do it.
Or demoralized by the fact that he's got the best riders behind him time trialing together.
But if he could have found 3 seconds a kilometer more, he would have stayed away, but he couldn't. And, you know, and the Tour de France always throws cases like these up. So Alaphilippe last year finds himself in yellow. Everyone's like, it's cool. It's a little bit of French excitement. He wins the time trial. Like, whoa, where did that come from? He's not getting dropped on the climbs. Then he does get dropped, but he only loses, I can't remember, a minute, 38 seconds, whatever it was. And the closer you get to Paris, the more people are going, can this guy, and he's digging so deep, and eventually he just can't dig any deeper. He strikes the bottom of his own physiological reserve, and he loses the time and ends up, you know, not out of the yellow.
Thomas, if he wasn't in yellow, though, would he have been staying on those climbs?
No, he wouldn't have had the incentive to. So I think it's a conscious choice.
Yeah.
Like, true. He's going to say, actually, why would I spend everything I've got when I could actually save myself and try and sneak a stage or two? Which is what he's doing now. So Alaphilippe now is losing, I don't know, 12 minutes on a climb.
Mm.
Normally he'd lose 5, 3, but he's accepted that he's going to lose. He might as well lose 12 because 3 or 12 is making no difference.
But
12 gives him a chance of sneaking a stage. So I remember 2004, I was actually in France for this tour watching it. Thomas Voeckler got in a break and they had, I think the break finished 12 minutes ahead of the chasing group.
The tongue of cycling.
That's right. And so he had a 10-minute lead on Armstrong going into the last 2 weeks of the tour. And he was riding so far above what anyone thought Thomas Voeckler was capable of because of that yellow jersey. So, yeah, you get, with the right incentives and the right motivation, a guy will find something that even he probably didn't realize he had.
That's my question. And we all did it on a podcast. So, is there something there?
Of course. Yeah. Of course. Yeah. But in the end, Voeckler's physiology still stopped him because no amount of motivation is going to allow him to hold off like the better physiology of the guys who are hunting him down.
Mm.
So it's both. So you know what the problem is with the whole motivation thing is that then you get arguments like someone just wanted it more. Like Lance just wanted. I remember people used to say that in the American media, like Lance just wanted it more. Ulrich would have been a great cyclist if he was motivated. Well, how disrespectful to think that Ulrich didn't want it. Of course he did. He just didn't have the hardware and the software to get it.
So slightly gooey-ware.
So my theory on that was always like, among the top 10 guys in the world who are legitimate contenders for the Tour de France, over the course of 3 weeks, the assumption has to be that they're all equally motivated.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, how else?
It is an assumption, isn't it? Because maybe they're not all equally motivated.
Not
maybe
every single day. Not every single day, for sure. Yeah. So French cyclists often go out in the attack on Bastille Day.
Yeah.
Because it's a motivation thing for them.
Yeah, for sure.
A guy, you know, we've had tragedies in the tour where a teammate has died and then someone's gone out the next day. And now he's motivated by something bigger than just prize money and a bouquet of flowers at the finish line. So, yeah, of course it makes a difference. But all that's doing is putting him closer to his physiological capacity. You can't break. So like, let's imagine there's a concrete ceiling and then there are 3 or 4 glass ceilings beneath it. You can get through those glass ceilings because of tactics, incentives, and motivation. But eventually you bump up against an unbreakable one. That's probably the shortest summary I can give you to that.
Well, I think what you just said there is probably the right way to look at it. It's that motivation pushes you closer to your physiological capacity, but you can't overstep it. But I imagine there's that space underneath.
And so And one of the things...
We must get a sports psychologist on, I think, about it. We just need to talk to someone sports psychologist about this.
Someone who really understands it would be fascinating.
Yeah. You
know, an athlete who's become a sports psychologist would be great. Because one of the things that... I believe that you need, obviously, to have a... There's a minimum requirement for hardware and software, i.e. muscles, heart, lungs, and then software, brain. Mm. And then there's a minimum requirement for psychology and emotion, which is part of where motivation falls in there.
For sure.
And if you're lacking in any of them, then, of course, you are never going to successfully achieve because you might be highly motivated, but you just don't have the hardware. Or you might have all the hardware in the world and you're not motivated. But these things of like... where it's one or the other. Of course, then it's never going to be one or the other.
Mm.
False dichotomy of note. And in the end, the guy who wins is 100% motivated and 100% physiologically capable. And he's the one who's realized his physiological capacity the most through his psychological application.
I suppose it also only applies to cycling. Not all sports are the same because there is a big mental aspect to different sports.
Yeah. I mean, imagine tennis. Applying this to golf. I mean,
golf.
You choke on a putt and you go from first to 50th if you miss three putts a day.
That's right.
So, so in the end, I think marathon running, cycling, swimming probably. Swimming's a really interesting one because you get relay performances where guys produce in relays what they never produce.
Yes.
Every Olympics throws up a relay hero for someone, whether it's France, Australia, or USA or whatever, a guy who in a 4x100 just swims the sort of performance that make you go, wow, that guy's going to win the gold.
Yeah.
And he comes to the individual, he comes eighth.
Yeah.
And he's a second slower. Like, why? Yeah. Well, because the relay meant more to him. Listeners, don't assume that I'm downplaying the role of motivation. It's clearly important. Obviously, it is. It's like if you don't have
You started downplaying it. Now you've upplayed it.
No. If you don't have it, you're not winning. And I still maintain that in the end. So here's the thing. This is a non-answer.
as according to a sports scientist,
if physiology is equal, motivation wins. If motivation is equal, physiology wins. Obviously.
Right.
Now the problem is with two moving parts. How do you weight them?
Yeah.
You can't. So.
It's the holy grail of sports science.
Right. It is to some extent. But Thomas Voeckler and Alaphilippe had all the motivation in the world. They still weren't going to win.
Yes.
Because they lacked so much on the other side that they could not make up for it.
Mm.
Within themselves, they could exceed their own capacities, or own thought of capacities.
Yeah.
But they broke three glass ceilings and eventually they ran into a concrete one.
Well, I'm sure we'll see many fantastic and surprising and out-of-this-world performances over the next 2 weeks if the tour goes ahead, and I hope that it does. It has been an absolutely fascinating discussion today, and I hope you've enjoyed our podcast. We will certainly do a post-Tour de France podcast. We haven't even decided to do that, but I'm just saying that now because we will definitely do one because I think it is a fascinating subject and something that Ross and I feel very passionate about as well. If you want to let us know about what you think about your predictions, send us a message on Twitter. We are SportsSciPod. We're also on Instagram as Science of Sport Podcast, and you can either put your predictions on there and let us know what you think. You can even rubbish our predictions if you want. I will probably be wrong.
So just remind us what your podium was.
My podium, I didn't give you a podium, but I will now. I'll give you Pogacar, Bernal, Roglic as my top three.
It's the same three people, but the order is different.
Except the order is different. So I'm putting it out there, but please feel free, anybody on Twitter land, if you want to give us your predictions, feel free to do that. We will take a screenshot of the best ones, and whoever does get the right order, tell you what you should do is either support Ross and I. Tell us what you think, whether you support Ross and I. And also give us your views. Otherwise, we'll see you in the next couple of weeks for a next wrap-up of the Tour de France. And keep the comments coming, whether it's on this podcast or any of our previous podcasts this year or the ones that have gone past. But the good news is, I think we could probably announce this today, is that as of yesterday, we did 500,000 listens of our podcast in the last 18 months. So a massive thank you to all of our listeners. A bit of a milestone. What did they say about the first million? What's that?
Someone once said the first got to a million Twitter followers. Some celebrity rap artist or something said the first million's the hardest. And then someone replied and said the first 10 million's way harder. So
well, there
we go. First 500,000's the hardest. Exactly. We'll let you know when we get to 5 million.
When we get to 5 million, we'll really crow about it. But thank you to all of our listeners. But from us, it's goodbye and we'll speak to you next time.
Thank you for listening to the Science of Sport podcast. Follow us on Twitter at SportsciPod and on Instagram at Science of Sport podcast.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.